This is The Real Story from the BBC. I'm Rithula Shah with your weekly deep dive into a story that's making news and changing lives. For months now, the fear of a virus has taken away the freedom of millions around the globe. We've stayed at home, we've stayed away from elderly relatives, and we've kept our children off school. Now, as lockdowns lift, we're being asked to accept a new level of risk. Would you send your children back into the classroom?
If it came to it, I wouldn't be offering up my children to go back anyway. My children are not guinea pigs. Sort of practice run to see how things went at the height of a pandemic.
But humans are social, so could long-term isolation exact unknown emotional and physical costs?
My own mother lives hundreds of miles away, and I know she's wondering when she'll be seeing me and her grandchildren again. This is really tough.
We want to be safe, but we need our relationships and our freedom. How much risk are we willing to accept to do the things we want to do?
There's so many people out there that just want to hug their loved ones, and they can't. If they could, I think it'd probably change the concept of this coronavirus.
When it comes to COVID-19, can we balance the risks while remaining human? So we've talked a lot on The Real Story about the impact of coronavirus on our lives, on international relations, on the economy. But this week we're trying to assess how we interact with a virus that's likely to be present at some level within our communities for some time to come. How do we measure the risks we face? And is COVID-19 the most serious one? Or is there another psychological and emotional risk from the situation we find ourselves in which we aren't taking into account? To help us tiptoe through this maze of confusing choices, we're joined by Frank Faraday. He's Emeritus Professor of Sociology at the University of Kent here in the UK. Frank Faraday, give us an example of a risk that you've perhaps taken in your life that others might avoid.
Well, I do a lot of mountain climbing and I do a lot of skiing, including off-piste skiing, which for me is a medium through which I feel totally alive. And yet it is a very, very risky activity. And myself and a lot of my friends had multiple accidents. My wife broke her back twice. I broke my ankle twice. But I think on balance, given the choice, I'd rather go back on the piece sooner rather than later, just because of what it means to me.
That's an interesting perspective. Lenore Manderson is Distinguished Professor of Public Health and Medical Anthropology at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg in South Africa. She's on the line to us from Melbourne in Australia. Lenore Manderson, would you describe yourself as a risk taker, or are you risk averse? And give us an example of how that plays out in your life.
I would have said that I was not a risk taker. But I think other people might suggest I was. I work in South Africa, in Johannesburg, and Johannesburg is routinely upheld as one of the more dangerous cities in the world to live in. From my point of view, it's simply one of the most lively, exciting and vibrant cities in the world, and I can't imagine not working there. But having said that, I think that at the point at which Australians living abroad were summoned back to Australia, and I could perceive anxiety of others in Australia about me being there, I came back. And so that was my act of risk aversion.
Very interesting. And our final panellist is Andrew Penn. He's Associate Clinical Professor and a Psychiatric Nurse Practitioner at the University of California in San Francisco. He's on the line from the US. Andrew Penn, how do you deal with risk in your own life? And is there a risk that you might take that others would avoid?
Well, yeah. So as a frontline healthcare worker, healthcare carries with it a certain degree of risk embedded in the work itself. And of course, as we've learned in recent months, that risk is only amplified during a pandemic. So while I've been fortunate not to be in the front lines in the emergency department, the hospital in which I do my clinical work, we have it set up so that you can only come in and out through a particular entrance and everyone's wearing masks and such. So there's always been a certain degree of risk in working in healthcare, which comes with the job.
So you're living with this pandemic in a very real way and the risks it presents. Let's begin by thinking about how we as humans evaluate risk more generally. In many countries around the world, we willingly gave up our freedoms as the coronavirus took hold to mitigate risk. Now, we did that on the basis of government advice. But more generally, how good are we at evaluating risk? Andrew Penn.
Well, I think particularly when we're afraid, we're not very good at evaluating risks. You know, one of the things that we've learned from contemporary neuroscience is that when the limbic regions of the brain, which are those which have evolved to respond to fear, are highly engaged, that the areas where we use reason, the prefrontal cortex and such, is really gone offline. And when that happens, we tend to respond from a very reflexive place of fear. You know, the challenge with the current situation is that fear evolved to be a rapidly mobilizing force, not something which is meant to be sustained for weeks and months or even years on end.
Frank Verrede, you talked about your love of skiing. How would you say that we evaluate risk? How good are we at evaluating risk?
I think we're much better than specialists and experts claim we are. I often find it quite interesting that people tell us that people are irrational, especially uneducated people are not very good at making those calculations. And yet when I go down to my local bookish shop and I see fairly uneducated people sort of sitting there and working out the odds, you can see that they are calculating risk in their own ways. And certainly in my travels, I have discovered that in some cultures, particularly in Asian cultures, but also in parts of East Europe, people are pretty good at calculating risk. In the Anglo-American sort of world, we become extremely risk-averse. And as a result of that, people's calculation of risks are often seen as being not right by the experts. But what they forget is that those calculations may suit the life of certain people who have no choice but to live according to certain pressures that kind of bear down upon them. So I take a fairly optimistic view on our capacity to calculate risk.
Okay, there's some bits there I want to come back to, but Lenore Manderson, you have a foot in both camps here. As you say, your life in Johannesburg exposes you to risk in a way that perhaps people living in a comfortable Western city don't have to face. You're also in Australia. Would you accept that the evaluation of risk is different depending on where you live?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I really am uncomfortable at the point at which we say one group of people are more risk averse than the others. Some people live in risky environments, but they don't necessarily choose to. Other people choose to live intentionally in risky environments because it's exciting, which is, you know, part of my motivation in Johannesburg, apart from what I believe that I can give to that country, which I couldn't in Australia. But I mean, I think that the specifics around how one evaluates risk varies depending on the circumstance. So, you know, one comparison is the extent to which people continue to smoke, as they do in many countries, including in much of Europe, despite that they know the risks of lung cancer. And one of the big challenges for many public health epidemics and pandemics, including for HIV, was to translate an epidemiologic concept of risk to everyday behaviour. And what people tend to do is make a personal balance. If I do X, will I live or will I die? And they're not necessarily able to articulate the epidemiologic picture of what percentage of a total population might be at risk for particular activities.
But I wonder what you make of Frank's point that perhaps individuals are better at making these decisions than experts, technocrats, speaking to us from above.
No, well, technocrats, one assumes, and it is true in general, are making decisions based on the best advice available. Now, they haven't made the decisions, including the lockdown decisions, to prevent everybody from getting coronavirus. The decision-making was around allowing the spread of that virus to increase at a manageable level while other things got in place.
Frank Verrede, if I can bring you in, isn't that the difference, in a sense? There's differentiating between the risk to me as an individual and the risk to wider society. Are individuals capable of seeing that bigger picture? And at that point, don't we have to defer to experts, technocrats, who are looking at a much broader brush rather than the nitty-gritty?
Well, I prefer to see expert advice as being based upon the wisdom of individuals rather than simply counterposing them. And it seems to me that in many cultures, people learn to make decisions about the risks they face. For example, I've done a lot of work on child rearing and the way that parents relate to their children and the amount of independence they give them. Now, very often, that's based upon certain cultural norms. You know, for example, people in the Balkans are far less risk averse with their children than English people or Americans are. And I think on balance, that's a good thing. But also what's very interesting is that, of course, when you get expert advice, people interpret them in relation to their particular context. And people in general are able to use common sense to make decisions that are specific to their family circumstances, which sometimes contradict expert advice. Because as we all know, expert advice is not God's last word. It's not something that has a sacred kind of quality. It's something that we need to use to inform our decision-making. And it seems to me that at the moment, there tends to be a kind of pathologization of ordinary people's behavior. And there's an assumption that somehow left to their own devices, ordinary people are likely to behave in an irresponsible way. They cannot be allowed outdoors to go near beaches because they'll just climb all over each other instead of keeping a bit of social distance. And I think that paternalistic sentiment is really unhelpful at the present moment.
Andrew Penn, I wonder what you make of that. Is it paternalistic behaviour that's driving us, or is it that we've become wealthier, healthier, and therefore risk averse?
Well, you know, many of us have never dealt with anything like this. And the last time that we've really dealt with something perhaps this widespread was the HIV pandemic. And growing up in the San Francisco Bay Area and training at UC San Francisco, that epidemic is very much part of our history and a part of our culture. And one of the things I've been looking at is what can we learn from those very difficult days? And one of the things that becomes evident is that expertise is an iterative process, and that the advice that is given to the public not only will change, but must change as we learn more. And this being a novel virus, while we can prepare for pandemics, the specifics of the pandemic are going to be different, specific to each event. And I've been watching with a lot of curiosity how the advice given to the public has changed just in the last 2 or 3 months. We went from being mostly concerned about people who were symptomatic as potential spreaders of this disease to putting a lot more focus on asymptomatic patients.
That's an important point, isn't it, Frank Faradi, that this complicates the evaluation of risk, the fact that it's an unknown, even the experts are kind of making things up as they get more evidence, that there isn't a kind of an established pathway. Doesn't that make it more complicated, that relationship between people and the government or the experts?
I think absolutely. And for that reason, we need to be far more laid back about the advice we give, because you know, we're talking about calculating risk, but at the moment, it's not really possible to calculate risk because risk calculation depends on the idea that we have knowledge that allows us to make that calculation.
And well, do we have to be laid back, or should it make us more cautious?
A bit of both, because I think that advice needs to be laid back in the sense that, you know, what you think is important may not be the last word on the subject. And we need to have a bit more modesty in the kind of advice that we're giving, because most people, even the most sophisticated experts, you know, they still lack the knowledge with which to make those calculations rigid and clear.
So we've talked about risk in its generality. Let's think about a specific, an area that really where the evaluation of risk is complicated and emotional is when it comes to our children. During the coronavirus pandemic, in many, many places, they've been kept away from school. But how do we decide whether it's safe for them to return? So South Korea has been hailed for its ability to keep much of society functioning throughout the crisis. But there, too, schools were closed in its attempt to curb the spread of the virus. And that's until this week, when actually hundreds of thousands of children began returning to South Korean classrooms. And this is how they did it. On arrival, students lined up to be given hand sanitizer and to have their temperatures checked. Once they were inside, desks were spaced out in the classrooms, and there are some partitions between tables in cafeterias. The superintendent of the Seoul Metropolitan Office of Education, Jo Hee-yeon, said that the reopening of schools is a risk worth taking.
We're now entering a tense stage where we must pursue both education and disinfection. During the coronavirus pandemic, we've at least been able to continue classes online through remote encounters. But education takes place when teachers and students meet in person and build relationships in their classrooms, and when students build friendships.
The authorities in South Korea, though, have promised to close schools again and send everyone home if positive cases are detected, which has already actually happened in a number of instances. Here in England, the central government in Westminster wants to start reopening schools in just over a week's time. And while some parents can't wait to get their kids out from underfoot, many are less keen. Here's the view of one mother who recorded her thoughts for us while she was surrounded by her children.
I'm Jacqueline and I am a mother of four, although one is missing. Unfortunately, in our household, we've got two high-risk people. You're right, Bella. Well, actually, my partner's high-risk as well, but he works for the NHS, so he's having to go to work. But my daughter here had a heart operation about a month ago in Bristol. They discovered a hole in her heart. They discovered a hole in her heart, so had to operate very quickly on her to sort it out because it was left undetected for so long. My other daughter, she's also got type 1 diabetes, so while she's not at any more risk of catching coronavirus, if she did catch it, it can make her very poorly. So even without these issues going on in my household, if it came to it, I wouldn't be offering up my children to go back anyway. My children are not guinea pigs. There's no way I'd be offering them up as a sort of practice run to see how things went at the height of a pandemic.
That's mother of four, Jacqueline, speaking to us from the west of England. But in trying to work out how much risk is acceptable when reopening schools, one key indicator is Denmark. They started reopening classrooms there over a month ago, and as the BBC's Jean McKenzie found out, most parents were willing to accept the risks, especially given it was no longer business as usual.
It has been hard to not hug each other.
She says you can't hug each other, so you have to hug yourself. That's why.
Keeping kids apart requires some imagination.
Normally they sit two and two. You have the class of 20. It's been cut down to two groups of 10. That's why you have the plastic.
Because those two groups aren't allowed to mix.
No, exactly. When they're going outside in the breaks, we have to divide those groups into even smaller groups.
So the kids just have four other children that they're allowed to play with, and they're only given one part of the playground that they're allowed to be in.
My name's Sky, I'm 7 years old. We keep our distance when we play. You can't play catch.
What do you play instead?
The hula hoop.
Denmark reopened primary schools very early on. It was feared the infection rate would rise, and initially it did. But it's back down again. And with so many parents in work here, this was a targeted risk.
If we had to get the economy moving again, then we need to get the kids back into not only schools, but also daycare to try to enhance productivity for those forced still to work at home.
Well, that's three perspectives on what school may look like or the worries about school. Let's hear one more before we return to our panel. Tom Shivers is a science writer and one of the many parents who will have to soon make a decision about what to do with his kids. He's on the line. Tom Shivers, how old are your kids and how are they coping with lockdown?
They are 6 and 4, and the younger one has coped extremely well. And but apart from the fact that she's given up entirely wearing pants, she's doing fine. But the elder one is much more active and just misses his friends. And we're not as good at running around as his friends are.
I bet you're not. So you've been trying to weigh up all the competing science when it comes to children, when it comes to a return to school. What does it say?
Okay, so I should come right out early on and say it's incredibly uncertain. It's a fantastically difficult decision to make. But you need to work out, firstly, the risks of sending children back to school. And then you secondly need to work out the risks of not sending them back and leaving them off school, and what the costs of doing it either one are. The risk to children seems fantastically small. I've spoke to various paediatricians and statisticians about it, and I seem to remember so far the number of children under 18 who've died in Britain can be counted on two hands. It's obviously tragic nonetheless, but it is out of 30,000 deaths. It's very, very tiny, and much, much less than the risk of car accidents and things in that time for children. It's really for the direct risk to children themselves is extremely low, and then they seem to be less likely to pass it on. There was one finding in Iceland where they couldn't find a single example of a child who had passed on the disease to an adult. I'm sure they do exist, but it seems to me that they're less likely. There's also huge uncertainty about the damage of leaving them off school, right? So to many, many children that will be left at home to be more vulnerable to abuse or not getting their free school meals, or they will be suffering learning loss or socialization loss from not being in school. And these are real significant risks, as well as the economic damage from not sending children back from that, so their parents can't go to work.
So you've looked at the evidence, and actually the word that you said the most is uncertain. So yes. Knowing there's all this uncertainty, what's your decision as a parent?
So I don't want to criticise anyone for their own. I think my wife and I, you know, it's a joint decision, and we, I think, are leaning towards we'll send them back when it comes back, or at least the elder one, because I think he just misses it so badly and he wants to see his friends.
Tom Chivers, thank you very much. Let's head back to our panel then. You had lots of different perspectives on this school debate. I guess one question, and Frank Faradi, I suspect you've got quite strong views on this. Do you think parents are overthinking this?
I mean, as a parent myself, I can totally understand the hesitation. And I can understand, given the stories that they've heard, that people are wary of doing this. And I've written about this and suggested that the best way around it is to allow those parents who want to let their kids back to school to give them as much freedom and as much support as possible to do it, with the hope that other parents who are a bit more hesitant, a bit more anxious, will gradually see for themselves that it is, on balance, a far better decision to send them back than to keep them at home. And it seems to me that we cannot lay down a rule on this because so much emotion is involved in this. So we got to take into account the differential appetite that different parents have for taking or seeing this as a risk. And can I just say one thing that is missing at the discussion about this so far, which is that it's not simply about balancing risks. It's about balancing risks, but also in relation to what your goal is, what your objective is. For an individual parent and for a society, it is where you want to be next week or the next month that will play an important role in your decision.
Absolutely. And I think that's something I hope we can talk about in the next part of the programme. Lenore Manderson, though, we're having this conversation assuming that there is a choice. Is it a choice if there are also these other things to think about, which is the impact on the child?
No, I was going to come in and actually raise that point. In South Africa, but elsewhere in Africa and elsewhere in places like Bangladesh and India, for many people there is no choice because if children are at home and if there is lockdown and lockdown is enforced, then many people are going without food. And for those households and for those communities, the choice is we die of starvation or we take a risk and assume that the risk is not so great, that I will lose a child by virtue of that child being at school.
I'm going to ask you to hold that thought, but just to remind you, you're listening to The Real Story from the BBC with me, Rithala Shah. And if you haven't already, please do subscribe to our feed. There you'll find our past coronavirus-themed editions, including last week's deep dive into whether the pandemic is having an impact on global organised crime gangs. And a spoiler alert, it is. If you'd like to get in touch to suggest future topics, you can find me on Twitter at Rithala. But for now, back to this week's guests. Professor of Public Health and Medical Anthropology, Lenore Manderson. She's on the line from Australia. The sociologist and emeritus professor, Frank Faradi. He's here in the UK. And by Andrew Penn, psychiatric nurse practitioner in San Francisco. We were just hearing from Lenore Manderson about how there aren't as many choices facing people depending on where you live. I also want to explore this idea of a new reality. Andrew Penn, we heard from Denmark earlier in the programme where they're creating plastic screens in cafeterias and, you know, school is quite different for children. How do we cope with that? How do we find ourselves having been told there's this scary situation, we're kind of now being told you've got to come out of that scary situation and face a world, but the world that we arrive in is changed, and especially for children. How discombobulating is that?
Yeah, it absolutely is. It's been discombobulating for all of us. And I think it's easy to forget the speed at which this has all occurred. It feels like March was several years ago, when really it was just a couple of months ago. And in that short period of time, we've had to make some very quick decisions. And it's clear from looking and comparing, say, San Francisco, which has been relatively spared from this compared to New York, that the speed at which those decisions was made had real consequences. And so it's probably going to turn out in retrospect that some of the decisions that we made were overly cautious, were even possibly alarmist, but that those decisions can be dialed back and that risk can be mitigated. And that's an area that I'm particularly interested in public health is that of harm reduction. And so the idea that we can never be absolutely free of risk, but how do we mitigate the risks that we have to face? And some of these measures that they're taking in the schools in Denmark may turn out not to be terribly helpful, but we can dial those back. I would rather do that than to lose that abundance of caution and then have an uptick in infections.
Frank Faraday, is it a strange world that we're proposing to send children back into?
I think it is. And in the end, it depends on what we decide to do. And it seems to me that there's a danger that some of the precautions that we've taken, as the previous speaker said earlier on, may linger on for a while and may affect our behavior patterns. I think one of the things I'm worried about is not so much the children, because I think children psychologically don't have the same capacity as adults to compare what happened in the present with the past. What I am concerned about is that we do begin to distance ourselves from one another, that we begin to adopt practices that aren't really necessary, but nevertheless seem to make sense, that we should keep our distance. Well, like not shaking hands, like keeping our distance in the outdoors, when, in fact, it seems to me that in the outdoors we can be much more flexible in the way we interact with each other than indoors. And what I'm really worried about is that, in general, the element of socialization, which has been already been put to question before the pandemic, as more and more people live more atomized lives. I think that.
I mean, would you shake hands? Do you shake hands at the moment?
I think it's a personal decision. I would shake hands. I keep clean. I wash my hands when necessary. I had this experience, which sums up the problem, was I was kind of queuing up at a shop getting bread last week. I hear somebody shouting, hey, Frank, how are you? And I see an old friend I haven't seen for ages and ages. And he comes up to me, shakes my hands, and he said, oh, we shouldn't have done that. And I thought at that moment it was very interesting, because everybody in the queue looked at us as if we were like Dracula. You know, we had committed this moral crime. But at the same time, it felt really good.
Lenore, yes, come in.
Children have always been surrounded by the physical embodiment of love and security, of being able to be hugged by someone, and to now say all people are risky until proven otherwise is a very odd way downstream to be living.
This idea of human contact and human touch, which I think is such an interesting one, and it's one that, in a sense, has been bubbling up in the public discourse here in the UK. If questions to ministers and other government officials is any indication at all, plenty of people here in Britain want to know when it will be safe to meet up with relatives and other loved ones.
Is being able to hug our closest family one of the first steps out of lockdown? Well, thank you, Lynn, for that question. We understand the impact of not being able to hug your closest family. It affects all of us too.
My own mother lives hundreds of miles away, and I know she's wondering when she'll be seeing me and her grandchildren again. This is really tough.
We're social creatures. People need people for their mental health. And social isolation, actually, if you're locked down on your own, social isolation, the scientists reckon that's as bad for you as smoking 20 cigarettes a day.
And one British man gained a huge following online this week after he came up with a really novel way to embrace his grandmother.
A shower curtain and an inventive mind saw Anthony Colvin and his gran become overnight internet stars.
Thanks to this cuddle curtain creation.
It's basically just a clear shower screen curtain. These gloves are actually for farmers.
Your arms are through the bottom one. Okay? My arms go through the top one.
But I can give you a hug and I'm not touching you. Oh, but it feels like I am touching you.
The actual feeling of being able to hug her, even though you're not skin to skin, but you feel like you are, it's just surreal. Absolutely surreal.
That's Anthony Colvin on his makeshift cuddle curtain. Andrew Penn, is this something that we're almost on the brink of giving up? I keep seeing my mother, who's 81, and every time she sees me, she says, oh, we can't hug, we can't hug. I stand on the doorstep, she stands inside, and I hand her a food parcel and I go away. But it feels abnormal to both of us, and yet we're on the brink of giving it up.
No, of course it feels abnormal. It's heartbreaking to think of not being able to touch the people that we love, and even to have to dispense with normal social behavior such as shaking hands. And, you know, I think back again to the early days of the AIDS crisis, when the advice that was given to gay men was don't have sex. And, you know, frankly, that's not a viable piece of advice, maybe for a short period of time, but that's a normal human function.
Lenore Manderson.
People will break any kind of isolation. I mean, you know, all of the discourse assumes that people live in families, they have households, but an awful lot of people live alone. And a lot of people who are young are living alone and don't want to live alone. You can't end up having a relationship for the rest of your life mediated by a computer. And so, you know, there's a point at which body fluids are going to be swapped, whether people like it or not. And that's why I do think that part of the initial lockdown is around preparedness. It can't be about permanently keeping people isolated and preventing people from going out with people, hugging them, and simply being in the same environment as them.
Frank Faraday, you must take comfort from that, this idea that in the end where our humanity, our need to hold somebody, is going to be greater than any rule and people will break free. But there might be terrified epidemiologists out there who say, but this is a terrible thing, the coronavirus has to be contained first.
I do, but I think there's an important caveat, which is we're talking about all these new developments as just merely a reaction to the pandemic. But you have to remember that, for example, in the United Kingdom, also in the United States and Canada, there have been a proliferation of no-touch rules. What I'm really worried about is that we already adopted different forms of social distancing, even before the pandemic has kicked in. And I think a certain section of society will acquiesce to that, even when it's no longer necessary. That's my real worry, is that our culture is disposed towards distancing people from each other.
Andrew Penn, what do you make of that?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of criticism about the public health guidance, that it's been inconsistent or that it's been changing over time. And to that, I would say it has to change over time. And so we started out with these much broader guidelines than we possibly needed. And what we'll need to do and what the public is going to have to be okay with is the discomfort that comes with changing and reducing those rules or increasing them if it turns out there's an area that we didn't consider in the beginning stages of this.
But let's think about the way in which this more socially distant world we've entered may become the new normal. There's an assumption that the virus will be with us in some shape or form for some time to come. I just want to delve into the emotional cost of being isolated a bit deeper. Gabor Maté is a Canadian doctor who's known for his work on addiction and childhood development and trauma. How does he see this crisis impacting us?
The emotions can't be separated from our physiology. In fact, the emotional system in the brain is part and parcel of the same system that also operates the immune system, the hormonal apparatus, and the cardiovascular apparatus and the nervous system. So these are not really separate systems. They're part and parcel of a much larger super system, the connections between all of which parts have been firmly and fully established biochemically and neurologically and so on. So in other words, when people are physiologically ill, in vast majority of cases, that reflects emotional factors that have been present most of their lives.
So if you think about the situation that billions of people around the world have found themselves in, which is a lockdown to some extent or other, how might that interact with our emotional well-being and our physiological well-being?
In general, people are experiencing fear and uncertainty. Fear and uncertainty can trigger the body's stress apparatus, higher levels of cortisol and adrenaline. And then one of the things that mitigates stress and mitigates threat is the presence of connection. But that connection is precisely what's being lost right now. So it's predictable, and we're already seeing it, that there's an elevation in mental health conditions, in stress conditions, in addictive behaviors, in abusive relationships in the home as a result of the COVID crisis. It's hard to imagine that there will not be a long-term impact. And therefore, I would expect there's going to be a rise in a lot of physical health conditions as well.
One of the things that is a direct result of COVID-19 is that we can't hug one another, we can't shake hands. How impactful do you think that change of behaviour may be for us? How important is touch?
Touching is a physiological need that we have. Now, the younger we are and the less mature we are, the greater that need. So infants who are physically fed and looked after but not picked up and held will actually have a great chance of dying just because of not being touched. Now, as we mature, our dependence on touch diminishes, but it never quite goes away, because touch actually regulates the physiology. It releases soothing hormones in the brain. It relaxes the nervous system. It eases the blood pressure and so on, so that this lack of touch, especially for people who maybe have suffered a lack of it in their childhoods, is going to be very significant, I think.
You mentioned childhood. Obviously, many children have had a disruption to their lives that they would have been expected to leave. They're not going to school. They're not seeing their friends. You know, they're stuck at home, perhaps with their parents. Do you think that disruption matters in the long term? It's only a few weeks, a few months, perhaps?
In itself, that kids should be more around their parents is not a bad thing. One of the devastating dynamics in our society is that children have less contact with parents and nurturing adults than evolution has prepared us for. So that should happen in itself is not a bad thing. The question is, how are the parents handling it? If the parents are overwhelmed by stress themselves, then they can't regulate the child's emotions, because the child requires the parents' nervous system to regulate their own nervous systems. So if the parents are finding an opportunity here to really connect with their kids, to spend time with them, to play with them, to enjoy them, and can deal with their own emotions, those children will actually benefit. On the other hand, if the parents are upset, stressed, get hostile to one another, irritable with their kids, then the separation from their ordinary world is going to hurt the kids. So it all depends on the context.
Are there historical examples that we could draw a comparison with that perhaps show this link between fear and trauma and the health of communities in the long term?
So during the Blitz in London in 1941-42, those terrible Nazi bombings, some children, as you're probably well aware, were evacuated to the countryside to remove them from the threat and to save them from all the trauma. Those children did more poorly than those kids who stayed with their parents, because the most important thing was their relationship, and they lost that. So we know that these big historical events that affect a lot of people can have traumatic imprints later on.
How do you think that we can protect ourselves emotionally and perhaps even physically in this situation where there's so much uncertainty? It's not at all clear when we'll arrive at something approaching what we used to think of as normal.
That's an essential question. And I know for myself, I'm relatively protected. I'm not economically threatened, but I've felt the heaviness, you know, and sometimes I've felt the fear, and it's not even specific. It's just a feeling in my body. And I think a lot of people are experiencing that, regardless of the immediate threat to them. So how do you handle that? Well, from the emotional point of view, we can notice these feelings and not try to push them away, not try to minimize them, but just to accept, yeah, this is hard and I'm going through something and I'm going to accept these emotions as they arise. Whatever opportunity you get, when emotions that are difficult to sustain arise for you, if there's anybody in your life you can share them with, whether in writing, whether by Skype, whether by Zoom, by whatever technology, whether by telephone, do it. It's not difficult emotions that got us into trouble. It's our fear of them and our keeping them in. Allow them to be there and share them.
That's Dr. Gabor Maté. Andrew Penn, it is a strange world in which it becomes normal, as perhaps it has done for some people, never to leave your house.
It has. And You know, as Dr. Mate was talking about, we have this threat response system in our bodies in order to mobilize us into action. And one of the things that's been, I think, very challenging for many people who are stuck at home is that they aren't able to use that that response to a threat that we naturally have baked into us and be able to discharge that through action. And, you know, there's been a lot of work from people like Bessel van der Kolk looking at when we have a response to trauma that can't be discharged through action that protects us or helps us recover, that sort of stays remained embedded in the body.
And you brought up the example of HIV and how behavior has changed as a response to that. What about terrorism is another example of where we've been presented with a risk, and perhaps the risk is bigger in our minds than it actually exists in reality, if you were to measure the number of deaths, say, compared to road accidents or whatever. That's affected our behaviour. We've somehow managed to process that and put that into that file that says this is normal to live with this. Is there some sort of comparison to be drawn there?
You know, the challenge with preventing disease epidemics is sort of like, is similar to that of terrorism, in that I suppose if you're successful, it appears that you were overly cautious. That's not to justify draconian measures either in preventing terrorism or public health, but the absence of an event is seen often not as success, but as a sign that you were appropriately cautious.
And obviously, if people are protected, it's governments that take the credit. Frank Furedi, in the West, are we just used to governments protecting us, controlling us to some extent through laws, through medicine? And we're not used to uncertainty. We're not used to a situation where perhaps that protection, those laws, are not really going to be the answer.
Well, I think the biggest tragedy in the Western world is that an imperative towards micromanagement at work, the micromanagement of every institution, the whole institutionalization of process in all of our lives, has undermined our capacity for judgment and our confidence in being able to make judgment calls. And it seems to me that when you look at the history of disasters throughout the world over the last thousands of years, you'll find that communities that have the confidence to use their judgment are actually able to mediate the negative effects of a crisis like this. In fact, some psychologists have come up with the term a salugenetic effect, which basically means that you've gone through a tornado, you know, you've been a prisoner of war, you've gone through an earthquake, you've gone through a fire, and you survived. And the buzz that you get out of that actually very often for a lot of people serves as an antidote to the corrosive, destructive effect. And I think judgment plays a very, very important role in this. You know, how we react to a crisis situation is really interpreted through the prism of culture, the kind of signals our culture gives us about, you know, what is good, what is bad, how much risk an individual should be able to deal with, how much distress and pain should be able to handle and still be a human person. I think those cultural scripts that are directed at us, and they exist in all societies, not just in rich societies, ultimately give us either a lot of confidence or a certain good feeling about our capacity to survive, or alternatively, they emphasize and exaggerate our passive side. And I think in a place like the United Kingdom and in many North American, Canada and America, I think it's our passive side, our vulnerability that's being cultivated by these rules. There are important lessons we can learn from what are called disaster cultures, like in Bangladesh and other places, where people have learned to adapt to this. And actually, they don't get post-traumatic stress, or they don't have psychological illnesses when these things occur, because they have developed the resilience, the adaptability, and the self-confidence, albeit in a, you know, at a very local level, to deal with these things.
Lenore, I wonder what you make of that.
I think I don't agree with that. I mean, we do know that people have suffer enormous stress and suffering, and that there are high rates of suicide, which is perhaps our best way of getting at levels of stress in communities around the world. And it is not about people in poor countries being somehow inure or better adapted to having hard lives.
Andrew, we're nearly out of time, but just briefly, if I can bring you up on this idea of that political and cultural divide. I mean, clearly in the United States, that has affected how people view this risk and how they behave towards the instructions that they're given.
Yeah, it absolutely has. And we have a very polarized country at the moment, not only around this, but around many issues. And as we go forward, we're going to have to sit with a lot of uncertainty. There's going to be a lot of risks that have to be balanced. And we're already starting to look at what are called deaths of despair, you know, suicide, which was mentioned earlier, but also substance abuse and such. And really looking at the economic toll of being closed for an extended period of time and balancing that risk against the capacity of hospitals to manage surges of patients, and of course, individual people getting sick and possibly dying from this. And so there's going to be a lot of uncertainty and a lot of discomfort in the months and possibly even years to come, because, you know, until we have a vaccine, and, you know, I was thinking back to HIV, and in 1984, it was projected that we would have a vaccine within 2 years. And so here we are 35 years later. Nowhere, you know, we're still not with a vaccine. So it's quite possible this is going to be with us for the indefinite future. And so the question then becomes, how do we sit with that discomfort and how do we balance these risks?
The ultimate price of risk is death. So in the end, is that actually what many of us are afraid of confronting, Andrew Penn?
I think that's certainly in there. You know, I think that's how that was the first question I think most of us asked ourselves when this emerged, is how do I keep myself and my family safe? Which is an understandable first thing to think about. But as this goes on, we have to think about how do we think about risk not in absolute terms, but in terms of mitigation and in terms of reducing potential harms. And I think that's going to require a lot of leadership and a lot of nuance in our thinking.
Lenore Manderson, is it that in the end that we can't deal with, the fact that we have to confront death?
There are many deaths, of course, and I think that from the point of view of poor people around the world, the risk of starving is probably greater than the risk of dying from coronavirus. But the other fear around death is the loneliness of death, and I think some of the most distressing stories that are beginning to emerge, certainly from South Africa, have been the constraints around funerals and the constraints around mourning. And that's true for Australia too. And it does remind me not of HIV, but of Ebola and the resistance that occurred in Sierra Leone as people took people who were sick into the jungle so that they could nurse them. And if those people died, bury them as they wished to, rather than surrender sick people to the state and then, I mean, literally hand them over and not see them again. And that is happening around COVID-19 deaths and COVID-19 hospitalisation, that people are simply not able to say goodbye to people who are dying. And those kinds of stories that are coming out, I find very distressing. That goes back to the conversation earlier around risk and around touch. Okay.
Frank Faraday, do you think it is about this fear of confronting death when it comes to risk that makes the whole thing much, much trickier?
It does, but it's death in a much more pervasive sense, because we're not just talking about the death of the body, the death of the soul. We're talking about the death of social life, the death of culture, the death of the familiarity. And it seems to me that when you talk to people, certainly in Europe, about what disturbs them the most about what's going on, they say it's when they go outside and it's almost like you're in the middle of a zombie film, where you feel that you can't really touch anything, you can't really see anything, people appear to be walking differently, you don't get the same facial expressions in response to you. Something has died. Certainly that's the way it's perceived, and it seems to me that it's this expansive sensibility that a certain way of life may die that certainly disturbs most of us, probably as much as the fear of physically leaving our world behind.
Well, that's a rather big thought to end on. That is it for this week on The Real Story. Thank you very much to our guests, to Professor Frank Faraday here in the UK, Professor Lenore Manderson, who's in Australia, and to Andrew Penn in California. For this week, from me, Ritha Lashar, and the whole team, that's The Real Story. Thank you for listening, and do join us again next week.